This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, the U.S. dollar is an interesting thing. It seems to have a mind of its own, no matter what the people who print it say. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner went on the record again today in favor of a strong dollar, yet nobody in the foreign exchange markets was listening. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 11th of November today. The official U.S. government line on the official U.S. government currency goes like this. We favor a strong dollar. That's true no matter who's in the White House and who's doing the talking. We favor a strong dollar. On a trip to Asia today, the Treasury Secretary recited the relevant quotes. He said a strong dollar is important, whereupon foreign exchange traders promptly sent the greenback to a 15-month low against the euro. Maybe that's because currency traders seem to believe the real official policy is this. We favor a strong dollar, but a weaker dollar is okay for now. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports on why the administration seems to be saying one thing and doing another.
A cheap dollar gives U.S. goods and services a price advantage, both here and abroad. So why not change the official support for a strong dollar?
I think they're worried that if they change the phrase, they don't know what will happen. So to some extent, it's just inertia.
NCMA global economist David Malpass says the government has been giving only a wink and a nod to a strong dollar policy for nearly 10 years. A flood of dollars into the financial system has devalued the currency, and low interest rates have sent investors elsewhere for better returns. Not the kind of policies that would create a strong dollar. But Bruce Bartlett, the author of The New American Economy, says all finance ministers have to at least say they support a robust currency.
A lot of what sets the value of a currency, at least in the short run, is psychological. And if people think the government wants a weaker currency, then there is a danger that it could fall precipitously.
While a weaker dollar may benefit U.S. exporters, David Malpass says there's a costly consequence.
When a currency is in a weakening trend, then it makes sense for corporations to borrow money in the local currency and create plant and equipment and the jobs abroad, because those assets go up in value and the earnings go up.
The result is capital leaves the U.S. And ever since the 1990s, Malpass says, capital flows have been more important to the economy than trade. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Macy's reported quarterly profits today, lost $35 million, less than expected, so not so bad. The real test, though, is going to be the holiday shopping season, which doesn't really start until the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, when shoppers break out their combat gear and storm the stores. But big discounts are already everywhere. Retailers like Walmart and Target and Amazon are selling popular hardback books for $9. Sears and Kmart have already cut prices. So we asked Ashley Milne-Tite whether Black Friday really even matters anymore.
New York office worker Farrah Davis has been known to get up early and hit the stores on Black Friday. This year, she says, she'll probably stay in bed.
For the past 2 years, anything that I've seen on sale for Black Friday has generally been matched at any other given time during the year.
She says it's not worth braving the crowds. Marshall Cohen is chief retail analyst at the NPD Group. He says last year, stores still had so much inventory in December, they slashed prices again. Shoppers took note.
This year, 51% of consumers are telling us that they are going to be shopping starting December 1st or later.
Black Friday may not be as important as it used to be, but it's far from irrelevant. Roseanne Morrison is fashion director of the Doniger Group. She says for a lot of people, Black Friday is a tradition, just like Thanksgiving itself.
You get up early, you get in your car, you drive to the mall. It's really a family event.
For some, perhaps. Cognitive anthropologist Bob Deutsch says it's often every man for himself. He says first there's the thrill of the hunt, and some shoppers go all out to fool the competition.
Like feigning disinterest or hiding items in the dressing rooms.
Once they've paid up, another primal instinct kicks in, a sense of power and the desire to show off their deeply discounted trophy. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
The Justice Department has indicted 8 computer hackers who prosecutors say pulled off a global ATM heist last year. Computers at the Royal Bank of Scotland were hacked. The thieves then allegedly cloned ATM cards and started withdrawing. They are said to have gotten $9 million in just a matter of hours. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports now from New York that the bank robbery of the future has become the bank robbery of the present.
Now don't anybody make a move. Remember, my men at the door have got you all covered.
That old-fashioned bank robbery scene from Abbott and Costello is just that, old-fashioned. Ori Eisen with 41st Parameter advises financial institutions on how to stop the new heists. They're online. And he says that gives robbers 3 advantages: scale, anonymity, and speed.
There's a very famous caricature that shows somebody robbing a bank, and the teller is telling him, you know, you can do it much easily online today.
Eisen says more money is now stolen with the click of a mouse than at the point of a gun.
Fraud is usually seen as a cost of doing business. So even if we'll say that it is in the billions on a scale of the top 10 banks, they still have enough revenue coming in to cover for it.
The FBI says online theft doesn't pose a threat to the entire economic system. Sean Henry is an assistant director with the FBI's cyber program. But he says hackers are getting more dangerous every day.
You know, we see this sometimes as a cyber arms race. The bad guys are constantly looking for new opportunities to breach networks, and oftentimes the offense outpaces the defense.
Henry says the victims will be institutions and consumers, many of whom don't even notice that money has been stolen from their accounts. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
They noticed money on Wall Street. Today, the rally continued modestly, though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Two years ago, employees of Blackwater, a private U.S. security firm, opened fire in a crowded square in downtown Baghdad. 17 Iraqis were killed. Dozens were wounded. Iraqi and American officials were outraged, and eventually Blackwater lost its rich security contract with the State Department in Iraq. On the front page of the New York Times today, we learned a little bit more about what happened after the shootings, about how Blackwater tried to buy the silence of some key Iraqi officials for up to $1 million. Mark Mazzetti had the story. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
These payments that you lay out in the paper today, they were, in essence, hush money for the Blackwater guards having shot civilians in Nisour Square that day.
As we understand it, the money, about $1 million that was sent in from Amman, Jordan, to Iraq, was designed for to pay Iraqi officials to silence their criticism of the company after the Nisour Square shooting, which took place in September 2007. It was also designed to sort of smooth the path for the company to get an operating license and not be kicked out of the country where, you know, as we reported, Blackwater was operating on a very lucrative State Department contract worth, you know, a couple hundred millions of dollars a year.
Did any money actually change hands?
As we put in the story, it's a little unclear exactly whether the payouts happened, and if so, to whom in the Iraqi government they went to. We have detailed the authorization of the payments by Blackwater President Gary Jackson, and that the money went from Amman, Jordan into Iraq and were given to Rich Garner, who was the Iraq country manager for Blackwater. At that point, it's a little unclear what happened with the money. Now, Blackwater continued to operate in the country until earlier this year, when ultimately the Iraqi government said that they were not going to extend an operating license to the company.
In large part because of the events of Nisour Square, right?
Yeah, it was one of several events. Blackwater, as many know, is a very controversial company. And inside of Iraq, there were a lot of allegations, not only on Nisour Square, but on other cases of, you know, firing first, asking questions later, and a lot of indiscriminate shooting and indiscriminate casualties on the part of Blackwater operatives.
It's worth mentioning right about here that on the merits of your story today specifically, the company denies it. And Gary Jackson, the former president who you say authorized these payments, basically said, I don't care what you guys write.
He said, I don't care what we write. And Kofor Black, one of the executives we talk about in the story, issued a statement that said he's unaware of a specific plan to bribe Iraqi officials.
You know, the entire event at Nisour Square was sort of a watershed for the issue of private contractors operating in war zones, providing these kinds of services. Has anything come out of U.S. policymaking that's going to change the way these kinds of things are handled?
Well, for a long time, starting in 2004, contractors basically were immune to Iraqi laws. So they could operate in Iraq and were not subject to, you know, the laws of the host country. That has changed, where they're under different operating rules now. And the government says, the U.S. government says, there's a lot more oversight of private security contractors. It's hard to really take to assess those claims about whether they really are under much more control and whether there is a lot more oversight. But at the very least, they are subject to the host nation's laws.
Have you guys gotten any calls from the State Department today about this report and about what might happen as a result of it?
We're still reporting the story, and we've not had an official response from the State Department yet.
Unofficial response?
We're continuing to report it and continuing to try to talk to people about it.
Mark Manzetti, the National Securities Correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Tomorrow in Rome, the United Nations will be hosting a summit on food security. The UN says more than 1 billion people worldwide now don't get enough food. A report out today from the United Nations Children's Fund links poor nutrition to a third of all child deaths under the age of five. It also says malnutrition is a cause of stunted growth in 200 million children who live in developing countries. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports that hunger is, in theory anyway, one of those problems that money could pretty easily solve.
Malnutrition is devastating to the health and economic prospects of a young child. Ann Veneman, executive director of UNICEF, says the negative impact of malnutrition on brain development can keep whole communities in poverty.
The children are not going to do as well in school. Therefore, they probably won't earn as much and contribute economically as well to the overall well-being of the country.
But nutrition programs often don't get the financial support they need. Not exactly health, but not strictly an education issue either, nutrition often falls through the cracks, even though the price is right, in some cases just a few dollars per child.
Nutrition interventions are the most cost-effective interventions we have in combating poverty.
That's Alan DeBrow with the International Food Policy Research Institute. He agrees that good early childhood nutrition can improve economic prospects.
Nutrition programs that were run in Guatemala in the 1960s actually had long-term effects on cognitive ability and even wages in adults.
Ann Veneman with UNICEF says international donors need to step up.
There needs to be more investment in nutrition generally. It has a very high and strong impact on children's health.
Veneman estimates that ending childhood malnourishment could cost hundreds of millions of dollars. We should get a more precise price tag in the next few days when the World Bank releases its own financial estimates. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
In this country, one of the biggest federal nutrition programs we have is called WIC. It offers billions of dollars in food vouchers for low-income pregnant women, infants, and children, hence the name WIC. Earlier this year, the kinds of foods that WIC vouchers would cover was expanded. For the first time, they're good for fresh produce, brown rice, and other more healthy foods in the hopes that children and expectant mothers will change their diets. The switch has also put tens of thousands of WIC-certified stores through some changes of their own, as Rachel Dornhelm reports.
Friendly Market is a bustling neighborhood store in West Oakland. It has a small deli counter, and its shelves are packed with snacks, canned food, and bread. Many residents of this low-income area do a lot of their food shopping here.
Okay, it's $3.42.
Owner Mary Kayad rings up a customer, then walks with me to the secondhand produce chiller she bought a few years ago so she could begin selling fresh fruits and vegetables. She shows me some bags of peeled garlic that have just gone bad.
See, look at this. See, these, because they were fresh. I'm not going to go for these anymore.
Kayad says selling produce can be a challenge. Order just a little too much, and any profits rot on the shelves.
I've been throwing a lot away. I've been giving away, throwing away. But once the vouchers are in place, and then maybe the kids will say, oh, you know, this banana's really good, Mom, or this is very good, you know.
The vouchers she's pinning her hopes on are the new WIC coupons. They include more healthy foods like fresh produce, whole grains, even tofu. These new vouchers will be worth billions of dollars in sales. That has some small stores investing in produce chillers, which can cost thousands of dollars, and new products to meet the WIC requirements. It's a gamble, but it's likely to pay off. California ran two large test programs in stores ahead of the changes. Lori True is head of the state's WIC Association.
Both pilots showed that not only was it easy to administer and very eagerly accepted by the WIC moms, but also the vendors loved it because they saw their produce sales go up and the increased foot traffic coming into their stores increased their overall sales.
Kevin Kincannon oversees food programs at the USDA. He says the first priority was changing the diets of women and children receiving WIC. But he says the government is also hoping that access to more nutritious foods will make entire communities healthier.
To the extent that especially these small stores are including these whole grains and fruits and vegetables, that can be an access source for other families in those communities.
Kayad says many of the customers at her corner store could shop at a larger supermarket, but it's a bit of a trek to get there, and many moms don't have cars, so they'd have to carry their groceries home. Then there's the shame.
A lot of people tell me it's like they're embarrassed when they go to a large store because then people are getting upset, you know, waiting in line and have to deal with that. So they don't want to go there where someone's going to see them get their WIC. So they like to come to a smaller store.
More stores of all sizes are applying for WIC certification. The USDA's Kincannon says in tight economic times, they may be attracted by the extra business WIC brings in. The new vouchers will be distributed by the end of December. In Oakland, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
Coming up, a new deep-sea delicacy.
It's very difficult to introduce an ingredient as an entree that people just aren't used to seeing in this area.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 0.4% today, 44 points closed at 10,291. The NASDAQ cranked up nearly 0.75%, 15 points, ended at 2166. The S&P 500 pushed up 0.3%, 4 points, closed at 1,097. Macy's stumbled 8% today after the retailer reported poor earnings, as we mentioned. CKE Restaurants got a grilling after it reported poor sales. Company stock ended the day down 8%. Good industrial news from China gave steel makers a lift. Nucor jumped 1.75%. AK Steel shot up 1.5% today. Steel Dynamics hiked 2%. Markets ended higher overseas as well. In London, the FTSE closed up 0.67%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.47%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. President Obama takes off for Asia. It's his first trip to the region. On the way, he touches down in Alaska to visit troops at Elmendorf Air Force Base. The International Energy Agency releases its monthly oil market report on supply and demand around the globe. And NASA discusses what it's doing to try to free the Mars rover Spirit. The industrious robot has been stuck at a location called Troy since spring. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The most recent round of news from the U.S. auto industry was more hopeful than it's been in a while. Ford is making money. Car sales overall are, well, at least not as bad as they have been. Commentator David Frum draws some larger economic lessons from Detroit's recent troubles.
Do America's highways look different to you? They should. Under the Cash for Clunkers program that ran through the spring and summer, almost 700,000 old vehicles were destroyed. The vehicle most frequently junked under Cash for Clunkers? The 1998 Ford Explorer. Number two, the 1997 Explorer, followed by the 1996 Explorer. All told, six of the top 10 vehicles destroyed under Cash for Clunkers were models of Ford Explorer, two were Jeep Cherokees, and two were minivans. The car most purchased? Toyota Corolla, followed by Honda Civic, then Ford Focus. Only one SUV appears on the top 10 purchase list, Ford's Escape, a much thriftier machine than the Explorer. America's love affair with the SUV has faded, and there is reason to think it has ended altogether. Even before the recession, sales of Hummers, Ford Expeditions, and other huge SUVs had already collapsed, victims of high gasoline prices. In this recession, gas has remained relatively expensive. It will likely remain so even after recovery. Chinese consumers bought more than 9 million cars in 2008. They will buy more in 2009, despite the recession, which means they, not to mention the Indians, will be buying more gasoline. While global demand for oil trends up, the debt-burdened dollar will surely trade down for some time. As Americans pay for imported oil with weaker dollars, gasoline will feel even more costly here than elsewhere. And cost-cutting will remain in vogue even when the economy recovers, as consumers save to rebuild the wealth they lost in the housing crash. So, farewell, SUV. Hello, Econobox. We haven't gone green, but we have gone broke.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Making your living on or from the sea has never been easy. Fishing can be dangerous. It's sometimes not very profitable. Increasingly, there are strict limits on how much fishermen can catch. And then there are the natural predators. Oystermen near the Chesapeake Bay are hoping they can turn their enemies into a tasty treat, as Sabri Benasha reports.
A few miles up Virginia's Cone River near the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, thousands of oysters are beginning their lives in metal tubs just below the water's surface. Oysterman A.J. Erskine pours them into a sorting machine.
They're about 3 months old, and they're ready to go in cages.
The cages, where these bivalves will spend the rest of their lives, are to protect them from what some oystermen call a growing menace, stingrays, specifically cow nose rays. Every March, they migrate in from the Atlantic, into the bay, and even a short distance up rivers, where they gorge themselves on oyster beds and disrupt habitat.
It almost looks like schooling sharks, because the wings break the water and it looks like shark fins.
Real sharks would normally chow down on stingrays, but they've been overfished. Biologists think it's one reason why the rays are becoming a problem. So to protect the Chesapeake's cash crops, like crabs and oysters, the state of Virginia is trying to figure out some way to keep the stingrays under control, some way to put them to good use. At the Sam Miller's restaurant in downtown Richmond, Mike Hutt is pushing fried stingray on diners.
Fried a taco. It's Chesapeake ray. It's fried, and it's made into a taco.
Hutt directs Virginia's Marine Products Board, and he's in charge of marketing Chesapeake Ray.
We try and develop it as a food source to take them out of the bay and have it on the menus.
They have ray fillets and ray strips, spicy and country style. The red meat is high in protein, low in fat.
The meat by itself in a fillet or strips is very bland. It tastes like what you add to it.
Hutt is shopping the ray in restaurants across Virginia. He's going to Korea and then Japan to drum up support there. You can probably guess what it tastes like. Here's customer Melissa Bowen-Reese.
It's kind of, oddly enough, it tastes like chicken. Are you sure that's not chicken?
People do seem to like it once they try it, but it's been an uphill battle, says Mead Amory, a seafood distributor.
Over the last 3 years, we found out that ray has, for some reason, has a bad connotation. Stingray has a very bad connotation for some reason.
Yes, some reason. Which brings up a very good question. How do you market something that's basically, you know, unattractive? Turns out history has an answer.
The first step is you need a name.
Bruce Necht is author of Hooked, the story of a fish called the Patagonian toothfish. It's a monstrous deep-sea creature with devilish teeth and oily flesh that nobody ever caught on purpose. Until someone decided to call it Chilean sea bass. It's not a bass, but calling it one made it seem safe. Chilean made it exotic.
It kind of took off when it became sort of the fish that trendy chefs in New York and Southern California wanted to have.
Stingray marketers have taken a page from this playbook. Instead of cow nose ray, they call it Chesapeake ray. They describe it as the veal of the sea for its texture. Oren Molovinsky runs a stylish upscale restaurant in D.C. called Me and You. He's figuring out how he's going to put ray on his menus.
Well, we don't put it on as an entree, for one. It's very difficult to introduce an ingredient as an entree that people just aren't used to seeing in this area.
He'll try it out as an appetizer first. It's not as big a commitment for the customer. If things really take off in restaurants, there are ideas floating around to use the discarded parts of the ray in medicinal supplements and use what's left after that to make fertilizer. In Washington, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of Look What the Recession Has Wrought. Rosewood Middle School in Goldsboro, North Carolina is, like many schools are, short of money. So a parents' advisory council came up with something a little bit different. Selling higher grades. Donate $20. Students get 20 test points they can use on exams of their choosing. State officials are none too pleased, but the principal said, hey, they tried selling chocolates last year, just couldn't raise enough money. So that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 44 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 15 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 added 0.33%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwartz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up on the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow, the latest on the labor market and an early look on Wall Street. And on this program tomorrow afternoon, a business plan for indie bands.
even if you're playing for 10 people and tickets are $5 and you lose money on the show, if you are making t-shirts and you're selling t-shirts to people, your band is a business.
Guitarist Chris Walla from the band Death Cab for Cutie. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.